Welcome to the latest episode of the Flaneur podcast. Today we look at a promenading production of Macbeth, a David Hockney biography, and Mike Leigh's new film, Mr. Turner.
I'm feeling the cold and slipping down my feet to the underground. And you saw all you never needed, I suppose. And we know, all we're gonna hear is an upper tone. And we know all we ever wanted is on the road. And our hope comes with fear all, but anyways. And our mindset is just
Underground by Swiss electropop duo From Kid. Theatre lovers, Macbeth the Omnibus is a production you should see. It's not a standard Shakespearean performance, as is immediately clear when you pick up your ticket at the outdoor box office and are also handed a head torch and a waterproof poncho, and offered a blanket. It certainly ups the anticipation more than being given a programme and being told to wait in the bar. Outdoor productions of Shakespeare are popular in England, but are normally restricted to the supposedly less wet months of summer. Omnibus, the new arts centre in Clapham, has chosen November for an immersive promenading version of Macbeth. It's a good choice. A Midsummer Night's Dream is never much fun when it pours, but Macbeth is ideal for a dark London evening and almost improves when the rain starts to fall. Starting on the streets of Clapham, the audience followed the weird sisters upon the heath, Clapham Common, confusing the evening dog walkers, who see a couple of tramps followed by a horde of people with head torches. The players pause at various locations, a makeshift stage in front of a statue, a burning brazier in the middle of the drained Cock Pond. The play begins to take shape amongst the locals walking home. It's dark, the actors light their own faces with torches, but members of the audience help with head torches. You are part of the performance, in control of the lighting, adding your beam and picking out details wherever you look. Macbeth and Banquo are fighting for a renegade paramilitary organisation. We meet their leader, Duncan, outside a derelict toilet block. The currency of friendship is a packet of fags. The talk might be of Scotland and England, but this is any number of failed states around the world. Places where murdering your way to the top is still a career path worth considering, where regicide might have consequences. But you can kill servants with impunity and just blame your fury. The first half hour or so is outside, but the bulk of the play takes part inside, mainly in a long room with seats either side. I sat halfway along and did at one point feel proceedings had taken a Wimbledon-esque turn as I turned repeatedly to see the action at each end of the room. It is lit with flickering strip lights hanging at wonky angles. Water drips incessantly in the background. These are not luxurious surroundings, but the hideout of freedom fighters. Here the crown Macbeth craves does not sparkle, but is already tarnished. His great ambition seems to be leader not of a great state, but of a bunch of rebels. The actors are close up, walking amongst the audience, the action near and absorbing. Gregory Finnegan as Macbeth is impressive, moving through the emotions the murderer experiences, showing the detailed horror that Macbeth inflicts on himself, but tries to keep hidden. Whether conflicted, uncertain, hallucinating or resigned, it is an intense performance of a character who acts against his better judgment and is trapped in a prison of his own creation. The rest of the cast work to create an atmospheric piece, helped by the outdoor dark and fiery locations. Roxy Music's Love is the Drug plays through the banquet scene, suggesting a motive for Macbeth's actions. Jennifer Jackson as Lady Macbeth demonstrates a harrowingly painful madness, though her influence on her husband doesn't appear malevolent enough. Samuel Colling's Banquo shares a poignant scene with his son. The Weird Sisters' interaction with Macbeth takes place almost unseen in the dark, their messages supplemented by video screens appearing to be hallucinations. Macbeth is clearly sick. The pacey, promenading approach gives an immersive group experience. You can be huddling in an alley watching Lady Mac high on a fire escape, or standing downwind of a blazing brazier watching the action through the smoke. There is time to ponder as you walk from one scene to the next, although with nearby busy road noise and no microphones, the words are occasionally hard to hear. The terrorist setting takes some of the force from Macbeth's evil. When Duncan is a naive king, his murder is abhorrent. The shock is lessened when he is dressed as one of the fighters, using cigarettes as gifts. Bloodthirsty changes in power are less outrageous in a terrorist organisation. If you think Shakespeare is not your bag, then try this outdoor-indoor version, which is involving, unusual and exciting. If you think you've seen enough of Macbeth and his murdering ways, this is an original take on the Scottish play and allows you a fresh experience. The main downside? This Macbeth makes traditional sit-down-and-watch theatre seem a bit staid. Highly recommended, as long as you have a warm coat.
Please.
First single, My My Oh My, from Norwegian indie pop artist Surfalot. Everything you wanted to know about David Hockney, and probably a bit more, is available in the second part of Christopher Simon Sykes' detailed biography of the British artist. It's now available and takes David Hockney's story from 1975 right up to his recent iPad images. Covering the most productive period of his life, it finds him flitting between Notting Hill, Bradford, and California. This is the time when he creates many of his best-known works, including the swimming pool paintings and opera set designs. Throughout the period, he is experimenting with technique and technology, whether creating his own paper or downloading painting apps for his iPad. The book starts with a wide photograph of Hockney at work in a field, his paints carefully lined up on a table, two canvases in front of him. It demonstrates how Hockney is inspired by life, but not beholden to what he sees. He is not attempting a perfect recreation of the scene. Instead, the few clouds are multiplied, fields are enlarged, colours are brightened, hedges are simplified, and trees appear. His filtered bursts of colour build a stylized landscape. Sykes has had access to Hockney's private papers and diaries, as well as family and friends, and has written a bouncy tale of one of England's most successful artists. Amusing anecdotes sit in amongst the art history. The appearance of his first hearing aid leads to a passage where Hockney explains to a friend he needs it to hear girls as they speak at a higher pitch than men. His friend replies, "Well, you can throw it away then." We also learn of his idiosyncrasies, when and why the blonde hair appeared, that he prefers to work at street level, and his extravagance whilst travelling. The 400 pages include interesting artistic details, such as the difficulties he had creating a family portrait, and his many experimentations with media. Reed pens, paper pulp, and dense film animation acrylics are a few of the methods Hockney has used to express his ideas. Then there is his use of new technology to push the boundaries of creation, from Polaroids in the 1970s to iPads in the 21st century. "Whatever your medium is, you have to respond to it," he says, happy for the method he chooses for each work to influence the final piece. Hockney will not be authorising anyone else to write about him, so this is the definitive record of his life and work. Entertaining and full of quotations, it is an in-depth trawl through Hockney's life. Though lengthy, it has sections interesting for both the general reader and the art historian. Mr. Turner makes 19th century England look like a place worth visiting. If NASA admitted it had working time machines and made them available, a popular destination would be Margate, circa 1840. Asked to name a famous painter of the period, many of us could name J.M.W. Turner, although maybe not be fully confident what those initials stood for. There's a reason for his continuing fame. However good his paintings are, Turner's greatest masterstroke remains bequeathing his work to the state. Whilst the Tate has a large collection of his paintings, there is no chance of him being forgotten, which gives a ready market for works about his life. We meet Turner when he is already middle-aged and successful, able to joke with the president of the Royal Academy and lend money to struggling colleagues. Turner is no paragon of virtue, and Timothy Spall plays him as a blustering brute, taking advantage of his maid and taking no interest in his daughters, who live apart with their mother. He is expressive in all he does, his fingers behind his back showing his agitation even when we can't see his face. Dorothy Atkinson excels as Hannah, who has looked after Turner and his father for years. A simple woman, she accepts Turner's occasional embraces, hoping for more and constantly being disappointed. Mr. Turner is visually attractive, cinematographer Dick Pope learning from Turner's own palette in his own colouring decisions. Tales from Turner's life are reenacted, most famously when he lashed himself to a ship's mast to better experience a storm at sea. We also see his Varnishing Day repaintings at the Royal Academy's summer exhibition, and his sighting of the Fighting Temeraire that inspired the famous painting. In his paintings, Turner aimed for honesty. In his life, he didn't. He ran two separate households and a third establishment of children and their mother. He lived in a time when he could pretend to be Mr. Booth in Margate in Chelsea, and Mr. Turner at home with his canvas-stretching father, a lifestyle he would struggle to lead today. In other respects, though, he is a modern man, embracing pseudoscience and technology, until, with the daguerreotype, it comes too close to affecting his own livelihood. The most memorable feature of Spall's Turner is, and this can't be said about many characters, his grunt. As far as I know, Turner biographies aren't full of him grunting and growling. Sir John Soane's diaries don't record, "That Turner fellow is nice enough, but I wish he'd stop grunting." Nevertheless, here Turner speaks in a strange mix of high-flying language and grunting. As grunts go, they are surprisingly articulate, but given the power of film, Turner will now be unfairly labelled as the artist who grunted. It is easy to praise Mr. Turner, as it is based on an English fine art hero, but it will struggle to keep the attention, for its 2.5 hours, of people not interested in his painting. The screenplay lacks momentum, but shows that character flaws need not stop genius, and may even be a necessary part of its makeup. Spall's performance is engrossing, and the supporting cast of artists and acquaintance make a film that is of interest to anyone who wants to discover more of the background of the famous artist's work. Thanks for listening to the Flaneur podcast. For more details, visit our website www.flaneur.london.